One of the greatest clinical and research challenges in GI cancer and in oncology in general is pancreatic cancer. And I met with one of the leaders in this field, Dr. Margaret Tempero, to discuss this. And to begin, I asked how she would attack the disease if given a blank check for research resources.
I think I would understand a lot more about the biology of this disease. It's really going back to the basics. And one of the areas in this disease biology that needs a lot of study is the microenvironment. This disease has a more perturbed microenvironment than virtually any other. This has been evident forever in the histology. The disease is characterized by profound desmoplasia, sometimes to the point where the actual malignant component of a tumor mass is a very, very small fraction. And understanding what that desmoplasia is doing, how it's promoting the aggressive behavior of this disease, it's obviously not protective. It must be promoting the aggressive nature of the disease and how that's happening, and also whether it's a barrier to drug delivery. And this is a very hot topic right now about whether the desmoplastic stroma is really a barrier for drug diffusion. And there's a very interesting science article that was published last year from Dave Tuveson's group at Cambridge, where they actually showed that in a transgenic mouse model, that the desmoplasia was a barrier to drug delivery. And they could improve that with the introduction of an inhibitor of Sonic Hedgehog.
Sonic Hedgehog. I have heard that one, but I'm trying to remember how it works.
Well, the prevailing thinking is that the tumor has activated Sonic Hedgehog, and that causes the stellate cells to promote this desmoplastic reaction. So the network, hedgehog network, is actually extracellular.
When you say network of proteins or what?
Well, it's a signaling network. Hmm. So, it's involving some crosstalk between various circuits. But most of the hedgehog activation is actually extracellular, probably not intracellular as we thought at one time.
You know, when I hear about the desmoplasia and the lack of access to chemotherapy, I kind of think a little bit more about Bev, although I know it's a different, you know, kind of situation, but I guess there has been that issue of does Bev in some way, in some tumors, I guess maybe more, I haven't heard about it in pancreas. You know, getting back to that, do you think there's maybe more mileage there, or is it a different kind of penetration issue?
Well, I guess one thing to remember is that we don't know everything about the activity of VEGF. There may be other things that VEGF is doing outside of angiogenesis. In fact, there probably is some autocrine activity in terms of a trophic signal for growth in pancreatic cancer cells.
With VEGF?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well, the tumor secretes VEGF, and the tumor also has VEGFR, so it can sort of feed itself, if you will.
Yeah, there's been that issue about whether even Bev somehow has a direct anti-tumor effect.
Right, that's the point.
Is that where it comes from?
That's where it comes from. So if you neutralize this growth-promoting protein, then you perhaps can have an inhibitory growth effect, even in the absence of any vascular effect.
So have hedgehog inhibitors been looked at in pancreatic?
They are just now being looked at. It's a very exciting area. I'm a little bit concerned about the fact that we haven't actually proved, and it's a difficult model to prove, that it's going to be an active agent. The closest thing we've come to is this knowledge we have in a transgenic mouse model. But I know that Dr. Koh in my group is working with the CALGB to introduce a hedgehog inhibitor in combination with gemcitabine in patients with locally advanced pancreatic cancer.
You talked about the microenvironment. What about other novel agents? I mean, when I hear the word microenvironment, maybe because we're doing so much hematologic stuff right now, I think about lenalidomide. Have any of those kinds of agents been used?
There has been some work with lenalidomide in combination with gemcitabine, but I have not seen the results of that. Well, I think probably the most exciting combination that is in a phase 3 trial right now is gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. And that's a very interesting drug. It's a bit of a party trick in the sense that it's a taxane that's coated with albumin. But the albumin is trapped by spark protein, which is also known as osteonectin, in tumor tissue. And there is a lot of spark, not only in the stroma in pancreatic cancer, but also in the tumor, in the epithelial component. And the early phase two results look very promising. This has been studies conducted by Dan von Hoff and his colleagues. And so now they're in phase three. But I saw some really interesting data, again, addressing this drug delivery, that the nab-paclitaxel may be causing some sort of stromal collapse. And that this is, again, in an animal model, but what they did was they treated these primary tumor xenografts, which basically you take tumor from a patient and you implant it into a mouse. And so it's a bit better tumor model, I think, a preclinical tumor model, because you maintain some of the heterogeneity of this disease rather than just an isolated cell line. And some of the stromal components are there too. And they were able to show that after treatment with Abraxane that there was less stroma, and there was about 3.5 times the amount of gemcitabine in the tumor tissue. So getting back to the issue of drug delivery, and it may be that the effect of Abraxane is not so much, or nab-paclitaxel is not so much that drug, but how that drug allows the other drug to get into the tumor tissue. And if that's true, that ought to revolutionize our thinking in how we develop drugs in the context of pancreatic cancer. So doing it in the absence of addressing the stroma would mean that we would just be beating our heads against a wall continuously.
Right. And I think I remember that Dr. von Hoff presented some translation. Was that on SPARC, correlating with SPARC levels?
Yeah, there's a bit more correlation of response with SPARC, although it's not perfect. There were some patients who responded who did not have SPARC protein. So it's not perfect. SPARC wouldn't be a perfect enrichment tool, but that's one of the things I think they would really like to address in future trials.
So, I mean, theoretically, somebody could give gem nab-paclitaxel off study.
You can, and patients, you know, obviously can't wait for phase three trials, and I think there is a certain amount of interest in using the combination just based on the phase two data. I use it off-label when I can get approval.
Have any dramatic, long-lasting responses been seen with this, or really anything?
Well, the data, it's not been published yet, so I can't really discuss the data, but the data does look very promising with this. We're not talking about a disease like breast cancer, where you may have a couple years of remission on a given regimen. So I wish we were, but I think that somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 10 to 12 months of partial or complete remission.
Do you see that? Have you observed that with just gem alone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can see that with even single-agent gemcitabine.
How often?
Not very often. Not very often. Maybe 1 in 20, something like that.
Anything else that has, you know, again, even in early studies that you're excited about?
Right. Well, we're excited about a novel combination of gemcitabine and capecitabine. There's been a trial done in the UK led by David Cunningham that showed improvement in progression-free survival. Again, not in overall survival. And we have tried a different regimen using our fixed dose rate style of giving gemcitabine with alternate weak capecitabine, and that's being presented at the meeting here, where we're showing a median survival that will probably be in excess of 10.3 months for patients with metastatic disease. And that's actually a pretty good outcome.
Could you review this issue of the fixed dose of gemcitabine? And do you have any sense in terms of how well understood this is by docs in practice?
I think many people do use the fixed dose rate regimen of giving gemcitabine. You know, this was tested when we initially tested it. We were testing it against a very high dose of gemcitabine. It was a randomized phase two trial, and we gave sort of our standard fixed dose rate compared to a very high dose schedule of a 30-minute infusion of gemcitabine. And we saw a nice improvement in median survival, although it was a randomized phase two trial. It wasn't designed to show improvement in survival, but nonetheless we did. But we weren't comparing it to standard gemcitabine, so who knows how that would have panned out. But ECOG did a large trial in which they compared standard infusion gemcitabine to fixed dose rate plus oxaliplatin. And the addition of the oxaliplatin didn't do very much over fixed dose rate alone. And fixed dose rate actually was better than short infusion gemcitabine, but only by a small amount. And they had done what I think is quite appropriate. They said unless it's at a certain significance level, we're not going to call this clinically important. So you can have something that's statistically significant, but may not be clinically significant. I think we've seen this in oncology many, many times, right? So I think that one could argue that, yes, fixed dose rate actually is a little bit better, but let's not rest on our laurels. Even that isn't very good as a single agent.
What is the total time of infusion vary when you use fixed dose?
Well, it's 10 milligram per meter squared per minute. So if you're giving 1,000 milligrams, that's 100 minutes. So it's pretty easy to calculate it, but it's a long time in the chair. You know, by the time you have pre-meds and if you're giving a combination and so on, you know, the patient's blown a half a day in the chair. So it is a little bit longer. We have modified our fixed dose rate regimen over the years now, and we no longer give it as we initially published it. And that's something that I think people miss when they look at our publications. All of our subsequent trials have used an alternate week regimen. So when we studied gemcitabine and cisplatin, we used an alternate week. We studied gemcitabine, cisplatin, and bevacizumab, used an alternate week. It's very, very well tolerated. That's been another argument against fixed dose rate, is that it's more toxic. But it's not more toxic if you use our more recent regimens with the alternate week.
So you're using the fixed dose approach?
We have retained fixed dose rate in our clinical trials because it's, you know, it's like notching it up. You know, if you can get a little increment from that and you can get another boost from, say, the combination of either cisplatin or capecitabine, then why not? And because most of our patients have a very, very good performance status. You know, patients have to work at it to get to see us. And, you know, they have to travel often. So we tend to have a younger patient population and a very high performance status. The other thing, I just want to take a minute to talk about young people and people who may be in hereditary families, hereditary cancer families, particularly with the BRCA 1 and 2. Pancreas cancer is in excess in those families. And a lot of docs aren't aware of that relationship. And if you are presented with a patient who has pancreatic cancer, who's coming from a family with a BRCA mutation, you should really be thinking about using a platinum drug. These patients have better outcomes with platinum in combination with gemcitabine. In fact, sometimes have exquisite responses.
You're saying if they actually have BRCA mutations?
Well, even if you suspect that they are from a BRCA family, you may not have the time to figure it out. But if there's breast cancer in the family, other ovarian cancer, even just many other cancers in the family, they could be an HNPCC family too, or other many other mutations. But the idea that if they may have impaired DNA repair, then they're going to be more likely to respond to a DNA damaging agent such as a platinum.
Tell me my next question. You know what I'm going to ask you, right?
What?
PARP inhibitors.
Oh, exactly. Well, that's the second thing they should be thinking about, is getting on a trial with a PARP inhibitor.
Are there trials?
Well, there is a trial for patients with known BRCA mutations in pancreatic cancer at MD Anderson. But, you know, it's a very small group of patients. I happen to have a practice that's enriched for that. And that may be why our platinum combinations work so well for us, because we see more of that type of patient at UCSF.
So this is the only PARP inhibitor trial in pancreatic cancer?
It's the only one that I'm aware of, and it's in patients who have a known BRCA mutation.
So what fraction of all pancreatic cancer is that, like 1%?
Nobody knows the answer to that question either. I have seen reports of around 7%.
Really?
Uh-huh. But I think it's actually less than that.
And what about age? Is there a young age at which your antenna goes up about this?
You know, almost anybody that is below the age of 55, my antenna starts to go up.
I mean, enough to, well, you're going to give the platins anyhow. Interesting.
But if I have a choice, for instance, between a gemcitabine and capecitabine combination or a gemcitabine and cisplatin combination, if I see that the patient has either a personal history or a family history that might be consistent, for instance, I saw a lady recently who had bilateral breast cancer, who then developed pancreatic cancer, who now needs therapy. Well, nobody's done any testing. Nobody has time to do this. We will get it done, but I'm going to start her on gemcitabine and cisplatin because I think that she may have, and she's Ashkenazi, you know, so I think she may have a BRCA mutation.
Interesting. Now, what about the combination of gemcitabine and erlotinib? Where does that fit in? When do you use it? What do you think about it? How much of an advantage is it?
Well, this is an example we were discussing before where you may have something that's statistically significant, but because the improvement in survival is small, perhaps it's not so clinically meaningful for everybody. So that's what happened with that trial. Gemcitabine and erlotinib was compared to gemcitabine alone. It was a study carried out by Malcolm Moore through the NCIC. And it definitely was significant improvement in survival, but it was actually a pretty small improvement. On the other hand, there are probably a subset of patients within the cohort that really benefited greatly from the addition of erlotinib. So I think one of the responsibilities we have is to try to understand what that subgroup is and offer erlotinib to those patients. But offering erlotinib to everybody probably isn't a useful strategy.
Any translational work that's been done trying to make that correlation? Obviously, again, in some non-small cell, you have EGFR mutations and other tumors this has been looked at.
Well, you know, you might think that if the patient had wild-type RAS, they might respond better to erlotinib. So far, what little data we have doesn't actually support that, but that still is probably the prevailing thought, that the reason that most patients, you didn't see more benefit, was that most patients with pancreatic cancer have activating mutations in RAS. And if you have activating mutations in RAS, that is downstream from the EGFR signaling pathway. So you can block EGFR, but it doesn't matter because RAS is activated.
You mentioned, you know, more basic science work, trying to understand the disease. What about clinical research, the design of trials, any sort of major conclusions?
Well, I think this is something we have been preaching for a long time. The first thing is to not lump patients with advanced and metastatic disease, so advanced local and metastatic disease. The outcomes are very different. Maybe the biology may be different also. I've thought this for a long time, that patients with local disease who do not have metastatic disease may actually have a different biology than patients who present with metastatic disease. There's always a subset that cross over, obviously, but there's a very interesting study that was done by Chris Iacobuzio Donahue at Johns Hopkins. It was an autopsy series, and she identified patients in the autopsy series that had what she called oligometastatic disease. So in other words, the primary problem for the patient was progressive local growth of their tumor, and they never developed diffuse metastatic disease.
You say oligometastatic disease or locally advanced?
Locally advanced with oligometastatic disease. In other words, only small amounts of metastases.
But outside the pancreas? Though.
Outside. But the point,
primarily local.
Yeah, the point is, though, that you know, for years and years and years, we don't always understand why people die from pancreatic cancer.
Right.
You know, they stop eating, they have more pain, they get very disabled. But, you know, I always assume they had a belly full of cancer. But this autopsy series showed that they didn't. In fact, many people just died with progressive local growth of their tumor, and maybe they had a few peritoneal implants, but not a lot of systemic disease. On the other hand, other people had very wild spread of their disease, multiple organs, lots of tumor bulk. So she also identified some molecular patterns that seemed to be different in the people who had died with just oligometastatic disease versus the others. So there may be some very different biology in patients who have locally advanced disease versus metastatic disease.
Any estimates on what fraction is what?
Well, at the time of presentation, I use a 20-40-40. It may be 20-50-30, but 20% local and resectable, at least 40% locally advanced and unresectable, and 40% with metastatic disease. But getting back to your original question, the other thing that people agreed on, in addition to doing trials in these different extent of disease settings, was also to limit the trials to patients with very high performance status. And a reason for that is that another problem is when you get out into the community and you do these randomized phase 3 trials, the patient with ECOG 2 is really a 3, and the 1 is a 2, and the 0 is a 1, and I don't think we do a very good job of figuring out performance status. So if we just limit to the very highest performance status, 0 and 1, then we will minimize the chance that those patients with really poor performance status will be included in these large phase 3 trials.
You know, this issue of prediction of response, genomic predictors, you know, personalized medicine. And, of course, in a lot of tumors, we're seeing breast cancer with the Oncotype. Now it's coming into colon cancer. But you also were part of a presentation at ASCO in 2008 looking at genomic risk prediction models. What did you look at there?
This is a very important part of our program. And it gets back to my feeling that we need to understand the biology better if we're going to have more effective treatments, or even to use the treatments that we have right now. So, for instance, we have found that you can classify tumors as to their characteristics. It's a little bit like saying, you know, people with red hair and blue eyes, or people with brown hair and black eyes. They're basically just gene expression patterns. So they don't relate to anything. We don't know exactly what they relate to, but we have found that if there is a mesenchymal phenotype for the tumor cells, then they're more likely to respond to chemotherapy. This is work done by Eric Collison in our group.
Mesenchymal phenotype. So like how much tissue there's there or what?
Well, you can take, you know, back to the embryologic definition of epithelium and mesenchyme, and there will be certain genes that will pop up in those types of tissue. And you can classify these using gene sets. And we've looked at this in our cell lines, and we're starting to look at it in our human tumor samples to see if all of our gemcitabine responses actually end up in the mesenchymal phenotype. If that's the case, you could enrich by selecting for patients who have a mesenchymal phenotype for treatment.
Now, the mesenchymal phenotype is something seen histopathologically?
No, it's with a gene set.
I see.
It has to be done with a
gene
set.
So you can't tell by looking at it?
No, it would have to be. If this ever became a useful clinical decision-making tool, it would be a test based on either immunohistochemistry or, say, a gene probe onto tissue.
And what did you all use?
We use gene expression. So
RT-PCR?
Global gene expression profiling.
Right. But was it RT-PCR?
RT-PCR, right.
And what did you find?
Well, just that we could subclass our tissues. And about half of our patients, these were off-resection specimens, so we'd had no clinical outcome on them. But we could classify half of the tissues into an epithelial subclass and the other half into a mesenchymal subclass. So the other way to do it, I mean, those are just patterns, phenotypes, right?
Right.
The other way to do it is to look at pathway-specific genes that may be specific for the target or may relate to the metabolism of a drug.
Right.
For instance, and the work that you mentioned earlier about gemcitabine and the nucleoside transporters is a result of looking at things that relate to metabolism of the drug.
Right, and you're talking about the paper that was published in Gastroenterology by Farrell et al. Looking at that, and then you, along with Dr. Koh, did an editorial, and I love this little graphic, although I don't understand it at all. Maybe you can explain it in terms of what this means.
Sure, so gemcitabine's a prodrug. So it has to get into a cell in order to do anything. And it gets in through a nucleoside transporter. And cells will either express the nucleoside transporter or not. There are several classes of the transporters, but the one that was looked at in this particular study was called an equilibrative transporter. In other words, it lets gemcitabine in, and it also lets it out.
It's a transmembrane receptor?
It's a membrane receptor.
Right.
But it's basically the portal for gemcitabine to get inside a cell. Then it's phosphorylated, and it's the phosphorylated gemcitabine that gets incorporated into DNA. So there are a number of steps, and there are a few more iterations in that profile that we could talk about. For instance, cytidine deaminase inactivates gemcitabine. So if you have a lot of cytidine deaminase in the plasma, or if you have it in the tumor cell, and you have ENT, you can get it in, but it'll get degraded. So you've got something working against you. In some of our studies at UCSF that have been conducted by Kathy Giacomini and her group have shown that this degradation of gemcitabine occurs in patients who have a little polymorphism in that enzyme. And some people with a polymorphism in that enzyme have an amazing ability to just chew up gemcitabine. So if you knew that, could you address that by, say, giving higher and higher and higher doses of gemcitabine, for example? So, you know, we don't often push drugs to toxicity, but maybe we should be pushing gemcitabine to toxicity.
So this transporter is in normal cells?
So the transporter is in some normal tissues. It's present, for instance, in lymphocytes and leukocytes. So the transporter that was looked at in that particular editorial was one where they just looked, is it there or not? And they looked at on tumor tissue from a trial, an adjuvant trial, in which patients were randomized to either 5-FU and gemcitabine, followed by chemoradiation, followed by 5-FU or gemcitabine. And they showed that the presence of the transporter protein predicted for better survival only in the gemcitabine-treated group. So in other words, they showed that it was important for survival in patients who were treated with gemcitabine.
Yeah, you see like hazard rates of close to 0.5 with the gemcitabine, but then they look at, was it
the 5-FU,
and it's 0.93.
Right, right. So pretty high level evidence that transporter protein is important, and it makes sense. It makes perfect sense from what we know about the drug. So now what would be the next step? Could you use that transporter protein to decide whether in the adjuvant setting you would give gemcitabine or 5-FU and leucovorin? Because frankly, both drugs perform just about as well, you know, comparably when you look at independent sets of data, whether you're looking at SPAC or whether you're looking at, for instance, the CONCO data with adjuvant therapy, the outcome seems about the same. They have now compared 5-FU and gemcitabine through SBAC, and I haven't seen the final report, but it looks to be pretty much the same. So it wasn't an equivalency test, but I would say that either option in the adjuvant setting is probably fine.
I mean, you could use it theoretically, I guess, in metastatic disease too, right?
Well, interestingly, optimal 5-FU and leucovorin or continuous infusion 5-FU has never been compared to gemcitabine.
But I mean in trying to decide who to give gemcitabine to.
You could. Yes, you could.
Is this approach anywhere near, you know, coming to practice?
You know, I don't think that there is a lot of interest in fine-tuning this because I think people feel there's a bit of nihilism and feel that 5-FU isn't that great of a drug. I, on the other hand, think that we should be doing something to improve our treatment. Now, the other thing is say, well, okay, forget it. ENT or no ENT. Let's just combine gemcitabine and eflornated pyrimidine and give everybody that. And that's what's happening in the SPAC trial right now. They're comparing gemcitabine and capecitabine to gemcitabine. And we'll have to see what the results of that show.
What are some of the common questions that you receive from oncologists in practice about pancreatic cancer?
I think one of the most common things that we get is second-line options. That's one common question. The other is the importance of radiation. How important is that in the adjuvant setting and in the locally advanced
setting? So how do you answer those two questions?
Well, the second-line therapy question is a bit easier to answer because CONCO has done a very nice trial of looking at a regimen of 5-FU and leucovorin and oxaliplatin in second-line setting. And they'd first looked at it against best supportive care, but they couldn't enroll onto the trial. Nobody wanted to have nothing. And so they modified the trial and treated patients with 5-FU on the control arm. And it's a positive trial. So I think in second-line, that's a reasonable option. It's not exactly FOLFOX. It's a slightly different regimen. It may not matter. A lot of people are using FOLFOX because they're comfortable with that in their treatment of colorectal cancer patients. So that is easy to answer. The second one is the radiation for adjuvant therapy. Not so easy to answer, but again, if you look at all of the trials, whether it's chemotherapy alone or chemotherapy plus radiation, there's definitely benefit in adjuvant therapy, but the trials that incorporate radiation therapy have about the same 5-year survival as the trials that don't incorporate radiation. And there have been very few randomized trials that actually give us much guidance here. I'm not sure a randomized trial of radiation or no is so much worth our investment. It is being planned. There is a planned intergroup trial, but we'll see how much enthusiasm there is for enrolling patients onto that. I rather think that we should be investing in looking at new drug combinations in the adjuvant setting.
What do you yourself do outside of a protocol setting in terms of radiation therapy?
I tend not to use it, and I tend to use active drug combinations for adjuvant treatment. In our own institutional experience, we looked at this recently, our 5-year survival rate for patients with resected pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma is 40%. Now, we could have some real bias in the type of patients we see at UCSF, or our common practice of using combination chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting could have something to do with that.
What regimen or regimens?
Well, what I do is use whatever regimen seems to be working best for us at the time in patients with more overt metastatic disease.
So like tomorrow or
something? Right now, it's the regimen that we're presenting this week of gemcitabine and capecitabine.
You mentioned the 40% figure. To what extent do you think surgical skill comes into this issue? And what about selection of patients?
Well, definitely all of those things and the ability of the institution to care for the patient. So I think that it's not just the skilled surgeon. It's the institution and the hospital skill, I think, generalized skill, in caring for very complex illnesses. So, for instance, I would like to think that surgeons that do a high volume of pancreatic surgery and are used to seeing it have better nursing for postoperative care, have a better biliary team to handle some of the issues that come up for these patients. So I think it's more than just the surgeon, although you can't discount that factor at all. That's important too.
Yeah, you know, as I listen to you, I like how you're so oriented around basic science translation because, you know, I think one of the reasons maybe people felt kind of so, you know, depressed about the whole thing is these trials after trials of comparing two things that really weren't that exciting, or even looking at, you know, things that weren't that exciting. Any other sort of clues in terms of the biology or new agents out there that you'd like to see more worked on?
Well, there's interesting work now being done on the putative pancreatic cancer stem cell, and that could be very, very important if that's the major driver for metastatic disease, you know, the residual stem or at least early progenitor cell.
Any reason to think that's more of an issue with pancreatic than any other cancer?
Mm-mm. No, I think that's true for all malignancies. It's just that because this one invades and metastasizes so early, you know, at the size of a centimeter, already there are lymph node metastases in, you know, a third to two-thirds of the patients. A centimeter. So there's something really wacky about this disease and why it invades and spreads so very, very early. So it might become more important in that respect.
Anything coming out, being published, maybe presenting at ASCO as a sort of, you know, preview that's exciting?
I'm probably most excited about the paper we've got in a poster this meeting. You know, right now there are no trials that are close enough to completion that I'm aware of, where we'll be getting data, for instance, at ASCO in June.
What are the trials that are out there that we're waiting to mature that you're interested in seeing the results for?
I think the one we talked about before, the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, we're so interested in that that we're already planning an adjuvant trial, which will be a global trial in the adjuvant setting, and we're going to incorporate a lot of tissue biology into that.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about this poster you're presenting here?
Mm-hmm. Basically, we took our fixed dose rate of gemcitabine given every other week, and we combined it with alternate week capecitabine. The idea being that if you broke up your doses of capecitabine by weeks, maybe you could ameliorate some of the toxicity.
Of course, that's been done in breast and colon cancer.
Right, right.
But the Larry Norton memorial thing.
Right.
Has that been looked at in pancreatic cancer?
Not really.
So you did it in this?
Yeah, and I think our main motivation was to get a very tolerable dose of capecitabine, but yet with good drug exposure. And the trial that had previously been done by David Cunningham involved the so-called Schilsky regimen. It was 3 weeks of capecitabine. And that's a pretty tough thing for many patients to take. So by giving our fixed dose rate alternate week, it was less toxic. And having the capecitabine every other week, it was more tolerable. Dr. Koh determined the maximum tolerated dose for that and then went ahead and expanded the higher dose to almost enough to get some efficacy data out of it. And so when we look at the whole cohort, the phase one and the expanded efficacy cohort, our median survival in patients with metastatic disease is about 10.3 months. And our disease control rate, which is objective response plus stable disease, is 70%. So that's pretty good.
It is pretty good. What's the next step going to be?
We're incorporating nab-paclitaxel.
So phase one, two type thing?
It'll be exactly. Dr. Koh will determine the tolerability of that and the right dose, and then we'll have an expanded efficacy cohort. So I'm excited to see how this plays out.